Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Election grants received by Wisconsin cities in 2020 are under renewed scrutiny as Republican lawmakers question Green Bay's administration of the fall election. 2 million more Wisconsinites are expected to be eligible for the state's next phase of COVID-19 vaccinations.
And we also have to remember that COVID-19 is still very present in our state.
And a new nonpartisan report shows Wisconsin is expected to save an additional $1 billion over the next 2 years if it accepts federal funding to expand Medicaid. Rewind, your week in review for March 12th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Some Republican lawmakers are calling on Green Bay's mayor to resign and officials to launch an investigation into the city's handling of the November election. That comes after a story this week alleged the election was led by a privately funded consultant rather than city officials themselves. The story was published by a website run by conservative group Empower Wisconsin. The issue centers on the grant funding that the city of Green Bay and other municipalities in Wisconsin received from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which is largely funded by Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. That issue that was subject of many lawsuits, a couple lawsuits actually that were both unsuccessful in the previous months. The story was also subject of an assembly informational hearing this week. City officials who weren't invited to testify there said in a statement, quote, "The election was administered exclusively by city staff. We are confident that the election was carried out legally and with integrity." JR, Green Bay wasn't the only city that received this grant funding last year. Do you expect lawmakers will also look into Madison, Milwaukee, Kenosha, and other cities?
Well, look into those probably, but those are not even the entire list of those who got grants from this group. There were actually, I think, more than 230 cities that got some piece of money from this effort to try and provide funds to municipalities to help run an election in a pandemic. What's kind of interesting with this entire setup has been that it kind of fits in with the narrative we're seeing about election law debates overall, which you have a very one-sided view from the people who have problems with how the elections were run, by Republicans, without any Democratic input or buy-in. So with this hearing, for example, there are five witnesses. None of them are officials from the city of Green Bay. No Democrats on the committee participated. Now, that's a side issue because they've got concerns about social distancing and safety protocols and COVID-19. But there was no real Dem piece or opposing view brought up during this hearing. It's hard to kind of get a full airing of an issue. You're only hearing from one side. Don't forget the kind of lead witness in this hearing was Eric Cardall, a Minneapolis attorney who filed the lawsuit that was unsuccessful to trying to prevent these five cities from using these grants. You have to remember he also represented Kanye West in an unsuccessful attempt trying to overturn the Elections Commission's ruling that he turned in his nomination papers too late to make the presidential ballot. He also filed a lawsuit that has now led him to being referred to a disciplinary committee because it was an interesting, to say the least, attempt to overturn the results in Wisconsin. A federal judge said this was a step too far. It's grandstanding. We're going to refer you to this committee. So there's just all this kind of noise that clutters a kind of an interesting question of, is it okay to use private money to pay for costs to run an election? In one of the lawsuits, the one that Cardall filed on behalf of the Conservative Wisconsin Voter Alliance, the federal judge oversaw that case said that there was an appearance of, you know, maybe some impropriety here or issue of things not looking right, but there's no explicit ban in state law, therefore you're not going to stop from using that money. So those questions aren't really being the focus. It's more about these allegations about what may or not have happened, and you're only getting one side in this hearing process.
Yeah, it is worth noting that Senator Dewey Strobel, who with Senator Alberta Darling has introduced, I think, 10 bills that would enact election law-related changes. One of those bills would actually prohibit localities from seeking out private grant funding. And if for some reason that money is awarded, it would be given to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which would then be in charge of distributing that on a per capita basis. So lawmakers are, I guess, exploring legislative solutions in this field, I guess. But we haven't, I'm sort of surprised that Senator Kathy Bernier, who is a former county clerk, hasn't taken more of a lead in this space as these, you know, proposals are being considered.
You know, and she was one of the several Republican lawmakers I saw this week who called on the mayor, Eric Genrich, a former Democratic lawmaker, to resign and call for an investigation. She also, in her statement, put a note in there that this does not invalidate the results of the November election, but there are questions. And again, you know, in talking to people on both sides, yeah, you know, there are some issues to be explored here, much like the question about the Elections Commission's advice on curing absentee ballots that are missing information. You know, I'm not a lawyer. There might be, the commission may have gone too far in its advice to clerks. You know, that may be something worthy of a discussion, much like the use of private money is worthy of discussion. But in talking to people, there's just all this kind of clutter that's kind of concealing that issue, and you're not getting any Democratic buy-in. And why that's important is you have a Democratic governor. So do you want to get a bill passed, or do you want to, you know, create a show and have this and create a political point? At this point, Republicans are kind of left trying to make a political point because they're not going to get any Democratic buy-in that would get the governor to sign anything.
Right. And now let's hear from former Brown County Clerk Sandy Juneau, a Republican who testified at this informational hearing this week, followed by a response from Democratic Attorney General Josh Call.
When we talk about security of elections, we're talking about more than just the security of the internet. You know, it has to be security of the physical location where you're not giving a third party keys to where you have your election equipment. Also, you know, where you're storing your ballots, that they have the necessary security. In all the years that I worked with elections, I've never seen anything like this. And I really hope that as we look to the future, you can provide some protections for a municipal clerk who is appointed, so she's not at the whim of somebody who's going to try and take her duties away.
There have been months of baseless allegations challenging the integrity of our elections. Primarily, those have been promoted by former President Trump. But you know, for those who are concerned about restoring confidence in our elections, being clear that those allegations were false is critical. So with respect to these allegations, you know, if there is evidence that's submitted to law enforcement and we are involved in reviewing that, we would look at it with an open mind. And if there is any impropriety, that's something we would follow up on fully. But that would be the next step.
Republican lawmakers are looking to curb Governor Tony Evers' pandemic powers and also give themselves oversight over the distribution of federal funds tied to COVID relief in three new bills, actually. One bill comes as the state of Wisconsin is set to get some $5.5 billion in the distribution of federal coronavirus dollars in the latest relief package. That bill would give the Joint Finance Committee purview over Evers' plan for doling out the money. The other two bills include a number of provisions, such as measures to bar broad stay-at-home orders and prohibit governors from issuing successive orders tied to the same disaster or crisis. That second point is central to a lawsuit that's currently before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, tied to Evers' repeated issuance of mask mandates and underlying public health orders since the end of July. JR, it's been a while since we've discussed the mask mandate, which is obviously in part prompting the introduction of one of these bills. Do you have any sense of why the court hasn't ruled on this issue yet?
No, but everybody I talked to is dying to know. I mean, remember, the court heard oral arguments in November about whether the governor had the power to issue successive public health emergencies from the same pandemic, if there were unique events in that pandemic that gave him a foundation to issue the order. This was kind of a rushed case. There was really a lot of urgency to it at the time. Now here we are, almost 4 months later, and there's no opinion yet. And so I've kind of been asked a couple of lawyers, you know, like, what might be going on? And everybody's just guessing, right? But there are a couple of theories. One of them is that this court likes to write, or like I say, the court likes to hear themselves write. So the justices each like to issue their own opinions sometimes on things to flesh out their own views on how things should go. There's also wondering if they're having a problem getting onto an agreement, because you know this is an important issue, and if you don't have a central, clear, four-person argument in some way, shape, or form, you're not getting much direction to the state. So that might be slowing things down, but honestly, nobody has a really good idea right now or what's taking so long in a case that seems to be somewhat urgent in how we deal with this pandemic.
Right. The current mask mandate and public health emergency order, I think they're both set to expire on April 10th. So there's this, I think Republican lawmakers are sort of in this position where they're questioning, they don't want to piss off the court, right? But they're questioning, you know, we still have another month of this. The court hasn't ruled for, you know, for this long. Should we go ahead and maybe consider striking this down again? I'm not sure if you've heard anything on that front.
Well, at the same point, token, during oral arguments in November, the attorney for the governor kind of acknowledged if you saw a situation where Republicans came in and rejected a public health emergency and the governor issued a new one right away, there could be an issue there. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened earlier this year. And the court still hasn't ruled. So here we are kind of waiting, and we've had these things that they warned about in oral arguments playing out right before our eyes. And I just don't know what's taking so long at this point to get an order out on something like this.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on that for sure. Moving on to our next topic, 2 million more Wisconsin residents are expected to be eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine on March 29th, the Department of Health Services announced this week. By May, DHS also says that everyone 16 and older in Wisconsin will be eligible to get vaccinated, and that aligns with an announcement President Biden made Thursday night in which he directed states to make all American adults eligible for the shots by May 1st. That announcement came as a bit of a surprise to state officials yesterday, but this back to this current vaccination phase. We're currently in 1B. That phase was announced, and grocery store workers were notably excluded from eligibility. There was a big uproar at that time. Recommendations were reconsidered by the vaccine subcommittee, which is sort of dormant right now. But this time around, it seems like there's a similar reaction surrounding Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce and essential manufacturing workers. JR, what's the reaction been like so far to these recommendations and the announcement of the latest phase?
Well, what's kind of interesting is, you know, at one point, Wisconsin's one of the worst in the country in getting shots in arms. Now we're one of the best. And so some of the criticism that we heard about the early rollout has kind of vanished in the Capitol. But what you are hearing is kind of like a little bit of like nitpicking over, okay, well, this group isn't included. This group should be included. What's going on? We're getting kind of to the light. There's light in the tunnel where, you know, by early May, we're what, only 6 weeks away from May, 7 weeks away from May for most adults to be in the pool. That's significant progress from where we were back in January and early February. But what I'm wondering now is, you know, how is this process going to roll out? As you get more people in the pool, you also have to have more supply. And that's why we're seeing what's key at the federal level is the additional doses being purchased by the Biden administration, how that gets distributed to the states, and how successful Wisconsin is in getting them out into the people who are putting shots in arms. And one thing to watch as we get closer to that May kind of time frame, everybody, all adults basically in the pool, at some point, we're going to run into this wall of the people who don't want to get vaccinated. So what's going to happen then when you have, pick your percentage of population that refuses to get one, thinking, I don't need it, I don't trust it, you know, pick your reason why. How are we going to deal with that, and how is it going to affect the herd immunity that we're shooting for in Wisconsin and globally to help kind of tamp down this pandemic?
Yeah, exactly. And during the rollout of the current phase 1B, there is some frustration that immunocompromised individuals, others with pre-existing conditions, weren't explicitly made eligible under the age of 65. So there is obviously some, by prioritizing that group and not prioritizing the remainder of the essential workers that the CDC has recommended for 1C, I think there's some expectation from DHS that there's enough crossover between all of these groups that enough folks will be covered, but we'll have to keep an eye on that. Let's hear more from DHS Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke sort of explaining all of this.
Starting March 29th, we are expanding eligibility for the vaccine to Wisconsinites age 16 and older who have medical conditions that increase the risk for severe illness, hospitalization, or death from COVID-19. These medical conditions include cancer, heart or lung conditions, and diabetes, as well as people who are immunocompromised, overweight or obese, or have high blood pressure. Expanding eligibility to include Wisconsin residents with these medical conditions will mean increasing the eligible population by more than 2 million people. Healthcare providers may need to sub-prioritize within those groups and may consider factors as people with severe or unstable conditions, racial or ethnic groups, older age, or those with multiple conditions. We anticipate that Wisconsin will be able to open up eligibility to all residents age 16 and older by sometime in May.
A new report from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau shows the state would save an extra $1 billion if it does accept the federal Medicaid expansion dollars over the next 2 years. That's in addition to the projected $635 million in general purpose revenue that Wisconsin would save by adopting the expansion. The Evers and his administration have sought to prompt the legislature to accept these dollars over the last 2.5 years he's been in office. He proposed a similar thing in his first budget, but Republicans rejected it. Doing so this time around, though, would allow individuals, roughly 90,000 individuals, according to the governor's office, or those who earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level, to gain access to the program. Wisconsin is one of a dozen states that has not adopted the expansion and is the only one that did a partial expansion without taking the federal dollars. Republicans, though, have been staunchly opposed to this idea, calling it an expansion of welfare. Jer, we're at $1.6 billion, though, in savings, projected savings over the biennium. Does that figure change anything for Republicans?
Well, not so far for Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker. After the memo came to light, he said they will continue to oppose the liberal wish list of expanding welfare, that this is a non-starter. You know, look, the whole time I've been following this issue since 8 years ago, when Republicans first rejected the expansion through the Affordable Care Act, the question has been, at what point did it become too expensive to say no? And now what you have to look at with this kind of pot of money is separate them out. One of the arguments against the expansion 8 years ago was at some point the federal government would pull the rug out from underneath of us if we took the expansion and the matching money would go away and we were stuck with a bill. If Republicans couldn't get rid of the Affordable Care Act with full control of Congress and the White House, it's probably not going away anytime soon. So that argument about the money going away is not there anymore. So you look at, one, the pot of money from what the governor proposed in his budget and the assumption of the $635 million in savings. That money is generally going to be there each, you know, budget in and budget out, for the savings if you take the expansion. The sweetener, the $1 billion though, it's one-time money. That's something that's key. It only would be for the 2 years after implementation for those dozen states that have not done the expansion yet. After that, it would go away. So is that enough to pull Republicans in? Again, Robin Voss is still saying no, but might you see others start to kind of come around to this? You'd really have to see the Senate Republicans really kind of embrace this proposal and kind of go to bat for it to see it happen. And I don't know if they have that passion for it to fight Robin Voss over this issue. I mean, we're still kind of early in the process. People are still digesting that price tag. To Democrats, it's somewhat bewildering that Republicans keep saying no. I mean, they're trying to point out that, look, this extra money can go into reimbursement rates for rural hospitals, which happen to be in areas largely represented by Republicans. They can help small businesses who are struggling to get back on their feet to get another option for health care. It just helps people in general who are struggling with the pandemic. Why are you saying no? But for Republicans, this is a bright line in the sand, especially for Robin Voss, saying they're not going to do this. And it's just hard to see right now that they would back away from that position after as much as they fought it for the last 8 years. And, you know, really, they haven't paid a price for it politically. Democrats have said over and over again, you're going to pay for this at the polls, and it hasn't happened. So now we'll have new maps for 2022. Maybe that changes. But right now, if they haven't paid a price at this point, what price would they pay for continuing to say no?
Right, exactly. We're at the point where the question remains, at what point is that price tag, is that money too much to pass up? And I'm not really sure that we're at this point yet, especially with Speaker Voss still being so staunchly opposed. Do you have any sense of where Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu is at on this? He hasn't been as outspoken as Speaker Voss.
No, and Senate Republicans, they kind of want to talk about things as a group before Lemahieu, the leader, takes a position. So not sure last time they caucused. I know it hasn't been since his memo came out. We have to kind of see where they're at. But one of the big advocates for expansion in the caucus was Luther Olson. He used to be a member of the Finance Committee. He's now retired. So I'm not sure if there's a champion for expansion in that caucus right now who'd really go to bat for it.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the budget more broadly now, the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee announced this week a mix of virtual and in-person hearings for the budget starting next month, I should say. There will be three in-person hearings starting on April 9th at UW-Whitewater. The second will be April 21st in Rylander. The third will be April 22nd at UW-Stout. And the fourth will be a virtual hearing on April 28th that's available for everyone statewide. The announcement comes after more than 100 groups in February wrote a letter calling for more use of virtual and remote options for public comments this year given the COVID-19 crisis. The selection has drawn criticism from Milwaukee Democratic Senator Chris Larson, who said that there should be a hearing in the Milwaukee area. He said, quote, Milwaukee County generates the largest portion of the state's revenue, and yet Republicans don't see fit to hear directly from the folks who generate it. We'll hear from Co-Chair Mark Bourne on that in a bit. But first, JR, lots is different about the budget process this time around. Do you expect to see more differences in agency briefings and other portions of this process as we move through the budget in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, well, two years ago, there were also four hearings. Now, none were virtual. We were pre-pandemic 2 years ago, so things operate as normal. Important to note that with the Milwaukee piece of this, the last time the Joint Finance Committee wasn't in Milwaukee or its suburbs for a public hearing of the budget was 2005. Now, Mark Bourne, during the news conference on Monday, pointed out that Whitewater's in southeastern Wisconsin, so it depends on your definition of, you know, the media market, I guess, or where, how you define southeastern Wisconsin, but there's that piece. But 2 years ago, the Joint Finance Committee went to only having a half dozen agency heads come in and testify about the budgets before they went to other pieces of the process, you know, the public show, our public road show, the votes, that kind of stuff. We haven't heard yet what they're going to do with agency heads, if they're going to have more come in the last time or fewer. 2 years ago, they suggested standing committees, they have those chairs pull in their agencies that they have oversight of and do budget hearings on their own. The big thing I think we're watching is what's Joint Finance going to do as its first move with this budget, because 2 years ago, they created basically an entire list of all the policy that Governor Evers put into it and pulled it out in one step. That includes the expansion of Medicaid. So will we see something like that again this time? Another difference is Governor Evers is doing his own budget hearings. He's got six virtual hearings around the state to hear various topics. He and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes are participating a little bit, you know, kind of speaking at the early part, then dropping his work group rooms to talk some more. So they're doing their own effort. I've seen Democrats also doing their own budget hearings. Individual Republican lawmakers in our budget hearings. So there's a lot of attention, you know, a lot of chance to weigh in, but the main committee is kind of pared back a little bit from years past. We'd have more than four hearings.
Right, and Democratic members of the Joint Finance Committee, I believe, are holding, at least Assembly Democrats are, their own series of virtual hearings as well. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Obviously, we won't see members of AARP, who typically show up to every single roadshow hearing in their red shirts, appearing in person at the three that are in person this time around. All right, now let's hear from Co-Chair Mark Bourne in a briefing this week.
This committee has a great history of going out around the state and gathering that input, this time is going to be no different. We are not going to hide in Madison. We are going to get out there and hear directly from the people, just as this committee has always done. We also recognize, though, that times are a little bit different right now with the national pandemic that we're hopefully moving out of right now, and so we also will provide a virtual option. We certainly feel that we've chosen locations in different parts of the state, as well as then of course the virtual option, which is a statewide. So lots of opportunity.
Let's move on to stock picks. What's rising this week, JR?
Craig Thompson, the Transportation Secretary, recall that he is one of the original members of Tony Evers' cabinet who's yet to receive a floor vote in the Senate on his nomination. Now, 2 years ago in the process, he ended up getting a unanimous vote out of the Transportation Committee. That committee held another public hearing this week on his nomination. I expect another big vote for him out of that committee. The question kind of becomes, how is the Senate Republican caucus going to approach the Thompson nomination this time? Here's a little backdrop to all this, all right? In the 2018 elections, there were a number of ads running against Republican Senate candidates that were believed to be funded by the road builders. It really did not sit well with Scott Fitzgerald, the old majority leader. So when Craig Thompson, who used to work in the road building industry, was plucked for the transportation sector job, there's a little bit of a ill will there, left over from that 2018 election. You also had people like Dewey Strobel, a state senator, Steve Noss, another one, Republican state senator, were vocally opposed to Thompson's nomination. Now, fast forward, and what I've heard is that Thompson has worked well with both sides of the aisle. He's been responsive to Republicans. Some of the early opposition has softened. Fitzgerald is now in Congress, not in the state Senate. The question that people have is, okay, if Republicans don't have a unanimous feeling about Thompson's nomination, might LeMahieu take this to the floor if he's got 17 votes or 16 votes, or what's his cutoff going to be? There's been this perception for a long time in the state Senate that under Fitzgerald that he would rarely go to the floor unless he had 17 Senate votes. Why that's, or Republican votes. Why it's important is with 33 members, at 17, you don't need any Democrats to pass anything. I've talked to people so that that's kind of overblown, that perception. The real cutoff was at what point for Fitzgerald was putting something on the floor over an objection from a member going to cause him grief, right? That member's going to be so upset about that bill going on the floor, he'd be up, he or she'd be unhappy about it. So we're watching now with LeMahieu is, what's LeMahieu's cutoff? Does he have one? You know, would he go to bat for Craig Thompson? Numbers are also interesting to watch. So right now we have 20 Senate Republicans and 12 Democrats. There's one vacancy for Fitzgerald's seat. Representative John Jay, a Republican from Watertown, is a heavy favorite to win that seat in the April 6th election because it's a very, very, very Republican seat. So let's just assume Jagler wins, for example, in April. If that goes back to 21 Republicans, LeMahieu could lose four members and still pass with 17 votes. So just watch. You know, what's the if it does go to the floor, what's the final vote on Thompson? Maybe an early sign about how LeMahieu navigates that issue. And, you know, the caucus hasn't met yet. There are five new members right now. Jagler would be a sixth. So we don't have a good feeling yet where that caucus is. Dewey Strobel, I know, for example, his office said he's not there on the nomination still. But I don't get the impression that Strobel's going to whip votes against Thompson. Same thing with Chris Kapinga, now the Senate president. He wasn't in favor of the Thompson nomination before, but I don't think he's going to stand in the way of it going forward. So you just got to watch and see how that dynamic plays out. And don't forget, Thompson's not alone. We also have Dawn Krim, Department of Safety and Professional Services. She also has yet to get a floor vote. Didn't get a committee vote last time. There are some issues raised about an incident with her son like 10, 12 years ago. Also, there's always questions about that agency and how it's performing in its review process of permits for projects. Missy Hughes was not an original part of the member of the Evers cabinet. She had to wait, he had to wait 8 months to appoint her because of the law that was passed in the 2018 lame duck session that kept Mark Hogan that job for a while. So there's all kinds of intrigue, like what's going to happen to the Evers cabinet picks, because you also have Randy Romanski, who's replaced Brad Paff over at DACAP after Paff was rejected by the Senate. We have interim secretaries right now at Health Services and Tourism. How long will that go on? And we have a new appointment for DWD to replace Caleb Frostman, who Evers forced out over the UI debacle. So there's all kinds of cabinet moving pieces right now on state capitol.
Speaking of Paff, it was pretty interesting to see him on the Senate committee that was questioning Thompson during his hearing this week. I don't know if you found this striking either, but, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, Paff was voted down by the Senate, then joined the body, and is now questioning one of the two outstanding members of Governor Evers' original cabinet that has yet to get confirmed. Just a really striking exchange.
I think Brad has a unique perspective in the confirmation process. I'll put it that way.
Very well said. What's mixed this week, JR?
The unemployed. So here, we've kind of had this issue pop up before that Wisconsin, a decade ago, put in a one-week waiting period before you could collect unemployment if you were laid off. Now, the federal government, all these COVID bills, has put in a provision that if you don't have a waiting period, the feds will pick up a piece of that first week of unemployment for those who are out of work. So back in April of last year, a COVID bill passed on a bipartisan basis in the legislature and signed by Governor Evers. But it took long enough for that bill to pass that we missed out on $25 million in federal matching money to help pick up the cost of those unemployment checks. The Trump administration also rejected a request from the state to make that act retroactive and reimburse the state. Didn't work. Fast forward to this early late winter. There was a delay in getting another extension passed because, remember, Republicans put the suspension in a COVID bill that Evers vetoed. When he vetoed it, they knocked him because the state was going to lose money, $1.3 million a week, without that suspension in place. They eventually got it done. So we were looking at $3.9 million lost in matching money. From what DWD has told me now, they've applied to have that money reimbursed state retroactively. You have a new administration. DW says the new administration is not raising objections or requests so far, so that issue popped up before. Now we have another COVID bill that extends the enhanced unemployment benefits until September. It also takes the reimbursement rate for that first week from 50% to 100%. The question that we have to look at now is, will the state legislature, run by Republicans, do another suspension, that one-week waiting period? On the one hand, it thinks like a no-brainer, right? The feds are paying for it, so why not do it? But we're in the conversation, and I'm hearing grumblings from some lawmakers of, we already have a situation where you're seeing the unemployment rate is back down 3.8%, which is great, not quite pre-pandemic levels, but you have employers saying, hey, we're having a hard time finding people to fill jobs, so will Republicans want to embrace that one-week waiting period suspension again, or might we see that kind of go away at some point? Just keep an eye on that debate going forward.
And falling.
I just real quick, Rebecca Blank, the Chancellor at UW-Madison, not a great look. We have to apologize because you were part of an effort to kind of hide your discussions about bringing back football from the open records law.
Thanks, JR, and thanks everyone for watching. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
Tune in next week for Assembly and Senate floor sessions, and that's Rewind for March 12th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.